From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Police in Charlotte, North Carolina are anticipating more demonstrations tonight following the fatal police shooting of 43-year-old Keith Lamont Scott yesterday. Protests began peacefully last night, then escalated. Demonstrators blocked Interstate 85, looted trucks, and threw rocks at police. 16 officers were hurt. And this morning, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Chief Kerr Putney said Keith Lamont Scott had been armed when police first encountered him.
In spite of their verbal commands, Mr. Scott exited his vehicle armed with a handgun. As the officers continued to yell at him to drop it, he stepped out, posing a threat to the officers, and Officer Brentley Vinson subsequently fired his weapon, striking the subject.
Scott's family disputes this claim and says he was not armed. Well, joining us now with more is Nick Della Canal, reporter with WFAE, and he joins us. Nick, welcome to Here and Now.
I'm glad to be with you.
So first of all, Chief Putney said, in addition to what we just heard today, that police saw Keith Lamont Scott in his car with a gun and tried to talk with him. So what more did the chief say?
Right. Well, basically, police are saying the reason they were watching this man, Scott, in the first place is because they were searching for someone at this apartment complex who had an outstanding warrant. And it's still not really clear if the man that they shot, Scott, was actually the person they were looking for. Police really haven't said one way or another. Police are also saying that they basically watched Scott get into his car, or rather he exited his car with a gun, and then they watched him get back into his car with a gun, and then for a second time exited his car with the gun, and that's when they shot him. Yes, and police are also saying that immediately after the shots were fired, the officers requested medical aid, began performing CPR, but transferred to a hospital, but he was pronounced dead.
Now, Scott's family, as we mentioned, disputes this claim, and they have a different version of events. What are they saying?
Right. Well, moments after the shooting, a woman who says she is the man's daughter went on Facebook Live, and while live streaming the crime scene, said her father was completely unarmed, that he did not have a gun, and that he was actually just waiting to pick up his son and was reading a book. And that's the view that many protesters have been taking. Last night I saw a protester with a sign that read, "It was just a book," and several other protesters repeated that to me. At a press conference this morning, the police chief did say that body cam footage does exist of the incident, but he said the department doesn't plan to release it to anyone, at least until the investigation is finished. And it's really anyone's guess how long that could take.
Well, Nick, as you mentioned, you were at the protest last night in Charlotte. And I believe at one point you actually encountered a mother, Quina Jones, who brought her six kids to the protest. So let's listen.
Yes.
Don't kill blacks! Don't kill blacks! Don't kill blacks! No,
These are your kids?
Yeah, these are my children. I was watching it live at home, sitting in bed, and I was so rageful. I just decided, I was like, we have to get up. Everybody grab your shoes. Let's go down. I know y'all got school tomorrow. We're going to stay for a minute. But as you can see, I've probably been here for about an hour. So it's just disappointing to me, and I'm glad that they're finally doing something about it.
So, Nick, we've seen the images of the more violent aspects of the protest. Tell us what you saw last night.
Right. Well, yeah, there were some violent aspects. I mean, protesters were throwing some rocks and bricks at police. Police were firing rounds of tear gas. But no, there were also people here who were just there to peacefully protest. There were incidences of police speaking with protesters and having some kind of dialogue. It was around sometime around 1 a.m. The city's deputy chief, Vicky Foster, I saw her talking to a small group of protesters. And she was just asking them about their concerns and just listening to them. And in fact, at one point, one protester asked her, "Well, what would it take for me to get a better idea of what police go through every day?" He asked her if maybe it'd be possible for him to participate in a ride along with a police officer. And she said, "You know what? I think we could make that happen." So that was a nice incident of police and protesters actually talking and maybe coming to terms on something. It wasn't all tear gas and bonfires last night.
Well, in the last couple seconds that we have, Nick, Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts today called for calm and says she wants more peace and more dialogue in anticipation of more demonstrations tonight.
Yes, we know that there are two more planned protests for later today. One is planned at Marshall Park. It's a large public park right across from the mayor's office, actually in Uptown Charlotte. And we know of at least one other planned protest for this weekend. Police have said that there will be a police presence at both of them.
Well, Nick De La Canal is a reporter with WFAE covering the aftermath of the police shooting in Charlotte. Nick, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, a little less than 2 hours from now, the Federal Reserve will announce whether it plans to raise interest rates. Most economists are betting that Fed Chair Janet Yellen will wait until the end of the year to raise rates. Diane Swonk is an economist with DS Economics. She's with us from Chicago. Hi, Diane.
Hi, good to be here.
So what do you think is going to happen with this Fed decision today? Will they increase rates?
I think they're going to hold off a little bit longer. This Fed has been more skittish than not. And right now we still have an economy with a lot of mixed economic signals. And I think what they're going to do is delay at least until the end of the year. We're likely to get a holiday rate hike, one right in time for December. I'm sort of calling Janet Yellen as once a year Yellen these days. We got one last year, and I think we're going to get just one in this year as well.
And why wouldn't the Fed raise rates today, though? Because there have been a lot of good economic indicators recently.
Well, the economic news is still mixed. Although the indicators are moving in the right direction, we've seen the manufacturing sector continue to slacken, even though it should be starting to pick up. It hasn't yet. We've also seen that even though the labor market continues to generate jobs, the pace of job growth has slowed, and we've not really seen enough of an acceleration in wages to be confident that it will stick going forward.
The Fed last raised rates slightly last December. The markets fell about 12% in the 2 months that followed. Do you think there is going to be a correction like that in the market whenever the Fed does raise rates?
I think that's one of the conundrums the Fed faces, is that they actually have provided stability in the markets by staying on the sidelines. And every time they get involved again in trying to raise rates, the markets do jitter. The problem is we don't have the unambiguous strength in the economy we once did when the Fed raised interest rates, because it used to be you actually saw financial markets absorb those rate increases fairly good because the economy was just very strong. We also have a lot of uncertainty still abroad, and we know what happens abroad comes back and can wash up on our own shores here in the United States, most notably what's going on in China. Today, we also saw the Bank of Japan ease a little further on interest rates and actually increase their target on inflation, saying that they're willing to keep the policy of easy money going till inflation not only reaches target, but exceeds their target. They haven't reached their target in over a quarter of a century.
And why is that so important to us here in the U.S., what's happening in Japan? Because a lot of economists like you have been watching what's going on in the Japanese central bank very closely.
Because all of these things are interlinked now. We don't live on an island, as I said earlier, but it's really important that financial market flows can go around the world in nanoseconds. And I think that's really important, is that whatever happens abroad can influence rates here as well. And I think it's hard for the Fed, in the context of other central banks easing, for them to raise rates without there being consequences here. One of the biggest consequences for the Federal Reserve is a stronger dollar. You don't want a stronger dollar when you already have low inflation. It makes import prices cheap, but it keeps inflation lower than they'd like longer. It also hurts that manufacturing sector, which has really seen a very tough time for the last couple of years.
How is inflation looking right now in this country? This is one of the Fed's two mandates, is to keep inflation at the rate that it wants it to be. And over the last many years, it's been much lower than the Fed would like it to be.
Exactly. What we've seen is during the duration of the crisis, not only has inflation been below target, but most of it much below target. The good news is we've warmed up a little bit, but we're far from an overheating economy or an even comfortably warm economy. The hard part for retirees, of course, is that the things that they pay the most for, things like medical costs, just surged again after decelerating in their price increases. So the unevenness of inflation is becoming more of a challenge for the Fed as well. Overall inflation below where they'd like it to be, the economy a little more tepid than they'd like it to be. But certain groups out there, those who rely on things like interest rates on their savings, like retirees, are also having a harder time with some of the inflation numbers as well, because they're paying for prescription drugs and medical costs.
Diane, does the fact that we're just a month and a half away from a presidential election matter inside that boardroom at the Fed?
Some inside the boardroom of the Fed, if they think they have to raise rates, and many of them do, as a matter of fact, that makes no difference whatsoever, which I know sounds surprising to most. My own view is that frankly, if there's not a compelling argument at this stage of the game to do it, why do anything to be seen as if you're doing something to affect the presidential election? We have seen the Fed raise interest rates right through elections before, and that's something that's very important to remember. It last happened in 2004.
Although there would be some who would say that by not doing anything, the Fed is helping the Democrats because the stock market will stay kind of juiced.
I think what we have is a problem right now where the Fed, no matter what they do, is a political pinata. And again, that's one of the reasons why they just can't take the election into account. That said, do I think there's a chance that they raise rates in November when they meet just days before the election? I think that chance is absolutely zero.
Diane Swonk, an economist with DS Economics in Chicago. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
And all this week, we're talking about climate change. And today, we're going to look at how three cities in this country are preparing for the effects, starting with New Orleans. Jeff Hebert is deputy mayor and chief resilience officer, and he joins us. Jeff, what are your priorities when preparing for climate change in New Orleans?
When we talk about adaptation in New Orleans, we have the highest relative sea level rise in the country. Investments in coastal protection and restoration, investments in stormwater management, particularly on green infrastructure, and investments in energy and the way we build our buildings. All of those are wrapped into a long-term plan of how we need to rebuild and retool the city to meet what we know is coming 50 years from now, but as we've seen in the past 2 years, what is actually happening right now.
Is the biggest threat to New Orleans another storm like Katrina? Is it a hurricane that you're most worried about?
What we're most worried about is really a combination of a couple things. One is storm surge. So what happens in a hurricane or a tropical storm, a wall of water coming into the city. We've built the largest storm surge barrier in the country, one of the largest in the world that we built after Katrina. It's gigantic. We call it the Great Wall of New Orleans, and that protects us and has protected us thus far. So the storm surge barrier is outside the city, but inside the city, the rain that you've seen across the country, the rain that you saw outside of New Orleans and other parts of Louisiana, ensuring that we can continue to manage that stormwater is really important for us. So it's a combination of the two. So we've invested a great deal, but now we're moving into more green infrastructure because we've decided we just can't build enough pipes to pipe our way out of what we're seeing as these projections. So investments in green infrastructure, water gardens, large-scale parks and open spaces that can retain water and become sponges for water, that's the direction we're going in New Orleans because the hard infrastructure is just not going to do it to meet the demands that we're going to have over the next 50 years.
How much help do you get from the state government, from the federal government, and from private companies in working towards the New Orleans that you're trying to build to be protected against climate change?
We have great partners at the federal government, state government, and then what we pull together at the local government to move these projects forward. Of course, there's a national issue with infrastructure, and this isn't just New Orleans. This is our friends in Miami and our friends in Norfolk dealing with these very similar issues. There is not a huge amount of available infrastructure funding in the country for these large scale protection projects that we will need to protect most of the coastal United States in the coming years. So there is a huge gap there, and we fill it as best we can, but there is always going to be a gap until we come up with a national policy on infrastructure for this.
What about people who say, why bother with all of this? New Orleans is too at risk from rising seas. It's time for people to start moving out.
I think it's in isolation, people say things like that. But as we've seen all over the country and particularly on the eastern seaboard and the Gulf Coast, this isn't something that just affects New Orleans. In this country, it affects New Orleans, Miami, Norfolk, New York, Boston. This isn't just a New Orleans issue. This is a very large percentage of the population of the United States.
That's Jeff Hebert, who is deputy mayor and chief resilience officer for the city of New Orleans. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And next, let's bring in Matt Peterson, who is Chief Sustainability Officer for the City of Los Angeles. Matt, welcome to you. And when it comes to climate change, what are your biggest concerns?
Well, for Los Angeles, you know, our biggest concerns when it comes to climate change and the impacts are related to increased extreme heat for longer periods of time, drought, And, of course, related to both those, we have concerns around fires. And then, of course, after forest fires and fires in the mountains surrounding the basin, we have flooding and mudslides. So it's they're all connected in one way or another.
And what can you do about that? When we talk to people in other cities that are on the coast, they're talking about trying to keep the water out by maybe building walls or things like that. What about when you have to deal with the opposite in terms of more severe and sustained droughts? What can you do?
Well, number one, we need to continue to stay focused on mitigation and reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. How do we make the challenge less bad, so to speak? And that's why the mayor and the city of LA have set a target of 80% reductions by 2050 over a 1990 baseline year, and we've already reduced them by 20%. In terms of adapting to the realities of climate change, we've asked people to conserve water in Los Angeles by 20% by 2017. We're already at that level, and we need to keep it there. And we've done it by getting people to take out their ornamental front lawns, meaning the only person that ever walks across that lawn is the person that mows it or takes care of your yard. Then you should replace it with a drought-tolerant, California-friendly landscape. So we're beginning to see that change. We've had over 20,000 people take advantage of the rebates we offered through our utility. And then long-term, we need to build supply here. We need to clean up our San Fernando Valley aquifer that's our major groundwater basin where we store water. We need to do things like taking sewage water and doing advanced treatment or recycling it. And then capture the rainwater when we do get it. So we'll get about the same level of precipitation the modeling shows, but we're not going to have snowpack. We're not going to have the Sierra Nevadas and the snowpack be our long-term storage of water. That means that we're going to have more rainwater and going through our stormwater system. How do we capture it, clean it up, and store it for future use? So if we're going to have to do that and invest the estimated $9 billion for the county to invest in stormwater capture and cleanup, let's not discharge it to the ocean. We send so much water out to the ocean when we have a storm event. And we've set up this great conveyance infrastructure that moves water really quickly through the city of LA so it doesn't flood, including along the LA River. And we need to tap into it, divert that water to be cleaned up, stored. We're going to need to use cisterns. We've seen some major cisterns put under large parks, and that water is then being sold to nearby cities. So we just need a lot more of that.
We haven't talked about what you can do about sea level rise. Is that not something that concerns you there?
Sea level rise is a little bit less of a concern for the West Coast. And here in Los Angeles, our specific areas of concern are along the beach and certainly in Santa Monica, which is a separate municipality, in the Pacific Palisades. The beach is vulnerable to erosion due to rising sea level and storm surge. And then Venice, which is part of the city of LA, is lower lying. And so that's where we have the most significant infrastructure concerns. If we get sea level rise and storm surge, it could inundate our stormwater system and our natural gas infrastructure and overwhelm those systems. And we saw after Katrina and Superstorm Sandy the impact on natural gas systems and stormwater and water systems. It's significant. So that's where we're focused on. What do we do to harden that infrastructure? The port near San Pedro and Long Beach is fairly well fortified, but there's some lower lying residential areas, Wilmington, that we need to pay attention to and begin to think about long term as well.
That's Matt Peterson, who is Chief Sustainability Officer for the City of Los Angeles. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And one more city we want to check in on, Boulder, Colorado. Suzanne Jones is the mayor there. And Mayor, what's Boulder's biggest concern when it comes to climate change?
So Boulder's tucked right at the base of the foothills of the Rockies, and we live in an arid climate, and already we are living the effects of climate change. So in September 2013, we had a week of rain, and it dumped 17 inches of water, which is close to what our annual average precipitation is. And we had damage or destruction to about 1,000 homes. There were four deaths and over $150 million of damage to roads and various public infrastructure. So that was a real wake-up call that we need to be taking, securing our energy infrastructure and our other public amenities in order to prepare for climate.
What do you mean by that? What do you have to do to deal with these extreme weather events?
Well, some of the stuff is basic emergency preparedness, right? We have 15 creeks that run through our town, including Boulder Creek, which runs down the spine. And so we have built greenways, which also service as flood control devices along most of them. And the ones that we did performed very well in the flood, and the ones that we didn't, the water went all over the place and caused a lot of damage. So there's some basic stuff like that. But we almost lost our use of our water treatment plant. And that made us realize we need to figure out how to have emergency electricity backup for our critical infrastructure.
What about snowfall in the area where you are? Obviously, a lot of people go to Colorado as tourists to go skiing. How do you expect that to change over time?
Well, like many cities in the West, we depend on snowpack to fall in the winter and then melt slowly in the spring and be captured in reservoirs to provide our water supplies. So the fact that we're getting sometimes less snow, sometimes it's melting much quicker and running off real quick, well, we can see that we are going to need to be prepared for that as well. And luckily, Boulder has ample water rights that were secured long ago, but other cities around us are in a much more challenging position.
So in 5 or 10 years, how is Boulder going to be more prepared to deal with climate change?
We are doing two things. One is we are also trying to mitigate the impacts of climate change by reducing our emissions. On the adaptation side, we just announced a project at the Clinton Global Initiative in order to establish microgrids at 5 critical facilities around Boulder, such as our wildfire evacuation center. And that not only will mean that those buildings are more sustainable on the day-to-day, but it also means that if the grid goes down, that those places will have electricity and be able to supply basic needs for people in our community.
That's Suzanne Jones, the mayor of Boulder, Colorado. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Heather Bresch, the head of the company that makes the EpiPen, is testifying today before Congress amid outrage that her company dramatically raised the cost of the life-saving allergy shots while also raising her salary dramatically. USA Today healthcare policy reporter Jane O'Donnell joins us with more. Hi, Jane.
Hi, nice to be here.
And in addition to all of the things that we've heard about Mylan and Heather Bresch and raising the price of the EpiPen, you've got some reporting about her mother and what she did. Tell us about that.
Well, Gail Manchin, the wife of Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, is the former head of the National School Board Association, which represents all of the state school boards. As soon as she took over, she made it possible for Mylan to not only donate money to the association, which had been done before and for, say, sponsoring a meal, but to pretty much take over the policy guidance that this association gave to states and gave to schools. And that paved the way for EpiPens to be in school nurses' offices around the country and many laws to be passed.
How did that work, that laws at the state level would require schools to have EpiPens so they had to go out and buy them or what?
Right, exactly. There's 11 states that require them. A federal law passed in 2013. It was even called, which is fairly amazing, the EpiPen Law. Hmm. And it gave them funding preference if they were a state that had their schools buying EpiPens. So it made it pretty much the go-to epinephrine auto-injector of choice, even though there was very limited competition. And when more competition comes along, presumably soon, they will have already have a near monopoly.
And have you found through your reporting that Senator Joe Manchin ever stepped in here or put his finger on the scale?
As far as I can tell, his involvement was nominating his wife to the West Virginia School Board in 2007, and that was for a 9-year term. Once she was on that school board, she was participating in this national group. And when she became president-elect, she raised the possibility of getting her quote-unquote daughter's company to donate money.
Was any of this illegal?
No, but it does raise a very important conflict of interest. I mean, when you are a group that is supposed to be working for students and for taxpayers and the boards of education, to be allowing a corporate interest that financially benefits from this kind of activity, that they are able to sell more of their product, EpiPens. They do give many of them away, but it's only about half of schools participate in the program that gives them away for free or at a discount. they're in on the ground floor, and it becomes very difficult for anyone else to enter the market.
So what are you expecting from this hearing today?
Well, I think you're going to hear, I mean, Mylan hasn't said very different things, but they're going to say that the price increases were justified in some cases because they've made changes to the product. This is not a product that they developed,
right.
So it's not even like most drug makers where they're recouping the cost of all that research they did. And that, you know, they will emphasize, as they often do, that they give away a lot of these for free, and that is an important point. There are two states investigating that EpiPens for Schools program, by the way, where if you got them for free, you had to buy only EpiPens. That was a policy for a while.
That's Jane O'Donnell, a healthcare policy reporter with USA Today. Jane, thank you.
My pleasure.
More than 30,000 people will run the Berlin Marathon Sunday morning. Only a tiny fraction of them will run it very fast, and even a smaller fraction will come close to that magical barrier for male runners in the 26.2-mile race. That barrier is the two-hour mark. I mean, 2 hours, just think about it. That translates to running each mile of the marathon in about 4.5 minutes. Not just the beginning or the end, but the entire 26.2 miles, 4.5 minutes per mile. Well, that barrier is the subject of Ed Caesar's book, 2 Hours, The Quest to Run the Impossible Marathon, and it comes out in paperback next month. As part of his research for the book, Caesar lived and trained with some of the world's best runners in Kenya. And when we spoke last fall, I asked him to describe what that was like.
Well, I want to put this in a little bit of context for you. I'm a 6'5", 240-pound lumbering person. And so I did train with them, but I mean, they were running as slowly as they could, and they were doing it more to humor me than to get any kind of athletic advantage over me.
I'm asking because obviously, like, we're based here in Boston, and so every year when I watch the runners for the Boston Marathon, I sort of camp out roughly at mile 24. And even there, when the elite runners go by, it seems as if, I mean, they are doing what to me would be an all-out sprint, and they're nearing the end of a 26.2-mile marathon. So I was hoping you could give us a picture of what that's like.
It's so astonishing to watch up close. And often when I was watching the top guys train out in their mountain bases, I would go on a motorbike. And sometimes when they were doing their speed training, I couldn't get the motorbike to go fast enough to keep up with them. It was such a pleasure to really be with that level of athlete and just to see how they live. They live in these very humble circumstances in training camps in Kenya. Even if they're very rich, they wash out of a bucket. They eat the same food they've always eaten. You're talking about a group of guys that are so committed to living frugally and humbly and working as hard as they can. And the fruits of that are what you see, this kind of apparently effortless, beautiful motion that you see at mile 24 in the Boston Marathon. All this effortlessness comes at this huge cost. They run 125 miles a week in training. I mean, it's ridiculous to think about how hard it is that they work to get to that level.
Well, Ed, let's take a step back here and put some context around this conversation, because the current world record for the marathon is held by Dennis Kimeto, and he's run it in 2 hours, 2 minutes and 50-something seconds?
That's right.
Okay, so 202, and we're talking about a two-hour marathon, and the subtitle of your book is The Quest to Run the Impossible Marathon. I mean, is it truly that difficult to shave another 2 minutes off?
The short answer to that is yes. They've got to make a 2.5% improvement on what they're doing already, and they're very close to the limits of physiology as they are. I think it can be done eventually, and that comes from reading the scientific papers that say that physiologically we should be capable of running a sub-2 marathon, but I think it's going to take us a little while.
Right. How did we get to this point? Because, I mean, it wasn't that long ago in human history when we broke the first 4-minute single mile, and now we're talking about, you know, a 4.5-minute mile pace for, you know, an entire length of a marathon.
Well, what's happened, it became professional, you know, in the 70s and 80s, money started to be paid to top guys to enter the marathon. And in the 90s and, you know, the early 2000s, that really attracted the greatest talent pool of distance running in the world, which is from East Africa. And those guys have driven the sport onwards at such a fast rate.
Well, let's talk for a moment about one of the people who's really at the center of your book, and he's a giant in the world of running. It's Jeffrey Mutai, a Kenyan runner. You know, tell us about where he's from and how he became, you know, to be such a such a huge name in the world of running?
Geoffrey Mutai, in 2011, he ran 2:03:02 at the Boston Marathon, which was then the fastest marathon ever run. Later that year, he then broke the New York course record by nearly 3 minutes. And those two performances transformed the sport of marathon running. Suddenly, anything seemed possible because of what this guy, Geoffrey Mutai, did. And if you knew where he came from, you would feel even more astonished. You know, he grew up in a very difficult family background in a village called Equator in Kenya, which is actually just sits just below the equator line. He broke rocks as a teenager to make money for his siblings to go to school. He cut down trees for the power company in Kenya. And he didn't become a professional runner until his mid-20s. And from that point on, he had this astonishing career. And he's at the center of my book, not just because he's an astonishing athlete, but he is a beautiful, reflective soul. He thinks about running in a very interesting way.
Well, what did he tell you about how he views what running is and how it factors into his life?
One of the really gorgeous things that he told me about running was that if he's done the right training for a marathon, he gets what he calls the spirit, which is this kind of easiness in a race. And he tried to explain to me what the spirit was. Late in a race, which he's winning and he's feeling light as air, he doesn't feel the pain as much as he might do. And it's this feeling of total ease. And all his training is about trying to attain that kind of almost nirvana-like state of the spirit. And I think a lot of the Kenyans really do feel like that about running. You know, it isn't just what they do for a living. It's kind of a way to express themselves. It's not just a sport in Kenya.
Before we spend the last part of our conversation talking about what a two-hour marathon would actually look like, I want to just step way back in history because you tell a delightful story in the book about the circumstances under which the sport of marathon running really took off in the United States. And I'm not talking about in the 1970s, but way back in the early 20th century in Madison Square Garden in New York. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, there was an astonishing moment in athletic history. After the 1908 London Olympics, there was a very, very dramatic marathon race where an Italian guy called Dorando Pietri collapsed in the stadium in sight of victory. And the winner ended up being a guy called Johnny Hayes because Dorando Pietri received assistance from the officials as he crossed the finishing line. And so those two guys realized that they had a commercial opportunity for a rematch. And they came to Madison Square Garden and they raced a rematch inside, 262 laps. And they raced each other around Madison Square Garden. And it was a sellout. And there was almost a riot at the end because fans for Dorando, you know, were running against the fans for Johnny Hayes. And it was complete pandemonium. You know, the cigar smoke, there's brass bands playing, there's a riot. And somehow these guys running around this track 262 times in the middle. And that moment sparked something called Marathon Mania. For 2 years, everyone wanted to see, you know, people running against each other over this London distance of 26 miles and 385 yards. And that, more than anything, is why we run 26 miles and 385 yards.
And thank goodness we don't run it inside Madison Square Garden nonstop anymore. So here we are, more than a century later. If indeed someone said, I want to do this, I want to try to run the two-hour marathon, what would that actually look like? Could an individual achieve that?
No, I think it would have to be a team of guys who are the best in the world, who were all remunerated in the same way if one of them broke the record. And you need all the conditions to be perfect. So very cold, because marathon runners get extremely hot, windless. In those circumstances, perhaps in a few years, we might see a few more tilts at the barrier.
But when this does happen, obviously it will be an enormous triumph, an enormous scientific, a physical triumph as well. But would it mean something bigger in addition to that?
Well, at one level, it means nothing. 26 miles and 385 yards is an almost entirely arbitrary distance. But on another level, it means a huge amount. You know, the marathon is not just a distance. It's become a metaphor for endurance. Packed into that word marathon are all these ideas about pushing yourself through boundaries and, you know, overcoming obstacles. And I think for, you know, for people who run 5 hours in a marathon and for people who run 2 hours and 3 minutes in a marathon, it's the same. You know, you just want to get to the end and you have to dig very deep to do that. And so this great barrier exists at the moment, which many people think is impossible. For someone to actually overcome it would, I think, give us a sense of, you know, anything is possible. It's about what the mind can achieve over the limits of the body.
Ed Caesar's book is 2 Hours, The Quest to Run the Impossible Marathon. It comes out in paperback next month.
In Illinois, a poll this week from Loras College showed Hillary Clinton leading Donald Trump comfortably 43-30%. But the U.S. Senate race in Illinois is a different story. Republican incumbent Mark Kirk is facing a tough challenge from Democratic Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth, which brings us to our Senate tracker this week. WBEZ's Illinois politics reporter Tony Arnold joins us from Chicago. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, let's talk about Mark Kirk here, because he's presenting himself as someone who can reach across the aisle. He also mentions a very serious stroke that he had in 2012. Let's listen to an ad here from his campaign.
Long before his stroke, Mark Kirk was independent, ranked as one of the most bipartisan senators. After facing death, Kirk returned even more committed to serve Illinois. Mark was the first Republican to support a vote on President Obama's Supreme Court nominee.
Now, interesting, coming from a Republican candidate, and we know that he has really tried to distance himself from Donald Trump in this race.
He has, although it didn't start out that way. Kirk has for years been running as a moderate Republican. He represented a district in the House of Representatives years ago in Chicago's suburbs that's known as one of the biggest swing districts in the country. It tends to go as the presidential race goes. Hmm. So this is he's wrapping up his first term in the U.S. Senate. He won in 2010. In a year when Illinois kind of split the top of the ticket, they voted Mark Kirk for the U.S. Senate, a Republican and a Democratic governor that year. So he's kind of made his reputation on this idea of being a moderate politician who doesn't always follow the leadership, and so far it's worked for him.
And by the way, he has the seat that was occupied by President Obama when he was in the Senate from Illinois. What about Tammy Duckworth, who represents the state's 8th congressional district? She's also an Iraq War vet. Here's a recent ad from her campaign.
An enemy rocket took Tammy Duckworth's legs, but nothing could take her resolve. She served in uniform for another decade, dedicated herself to helping veterans, led important fights to get veterans jobs in a tough economy, and fight homelessness.
Tell us about Tammy Duckworth and her campaign.
Duckworth, she often is touting her biographical story about how her military experience has come into play. Her helicopter was shot down in Iraq, and she ended up losing both of her legs in that attack, and also partial use of her arm. And so she's been around. She lost a race for the U.S. House of Representatives in 2006 and ended up winning the seat back in 2012 or so. And so she's wrapping up her second term in Congress, and she's been kind of braced, I guess, for this big campaign here against Kirk to, you know, tie Kirk to Donald Trump in the top of the Republican ticket. And so this has kind of set the stage here between the two of them for this very large, expensive, very intense race here for the U.S. Senate.
And is Duckworth tying herself to Hillary Clinton, who, by the way, is also originally from Illinois?
Duckworth is tying herself to Hillary Clinton, and actually she makes a point to talk about how the top of the ticket in Illinois is going to be an all-female ticket, for the Democrats at least. For Mark Kirk, and talking about the presidential race, he started out during the primary saying that he would support the nominee even if it were to be Donald Trump, and that position has changed over the course of the summer, trying to fit in with this idea that he's this moderate Republican not tied to the leadership. And now, most recently, he's talked about writing in a candidate for president, and he's given a few different answers on that, on who he would write in, but most recently he's said that it would be David Petraeus, the former CIA director and general who ended up leaving under a controversy.
And has a lot of the campaigning been in the part of the state where you are, or are the candidates heading downstate to the places like where I'm from in Champaign-Urbana? Are they trying to get those downstate voters?
I think a lot of the fight is going to be for Chicago's suburbs. They've both been actually pretty limited in their public appearances, and they haven't been out in front of the cameras an awful lot for a race that's as highly watched and anticipated as this one. There's still even a debate over how many debates or what those debates are even going to be looking like. So the fact that they haven't even set up a schedule here for the final month is, I think, a little telling also about just how bad the relationship is between the two of them and what, you know, how much is at stake for this. They both are trying to refer to their own candidacy as the whole U.S. Senate hinges on whether it turns Democratic or turns Republican. Like, so goes this race, so goes the U.S. Senate, whether it's going to be a Republican-led Senate or a Democratic one.
And what did the polls say?
Most recently, the polls have shown that Tammy Duckworth has a slight lead over Kirk, but it's expected to be very close.
Tony Arnold, Illinois politics reporter at WBEZ, joining us from Chicago. Tony, thank you.
All right, thanks.
And as that Senate race tilts Democratic, a new analysis from the Washington Post finds that Republicans are favored to hold on to the Senate in November, although just barely. The Post now lists just four Senate races as toss-ups: Indiana, Nevada, New Hampshire, and Pennsylvania. Democrats would have to win most or all of those to control the Senate, depending on what happens in the presidential race. For a look at some of those races, you can go to hereandnow.org. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.